You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. We all know, or at least most of us know, that pesticides and fertilizers are poisoning our environment and ourselves. And most of us know that we need to make some very rapid changes to our sources of energy to keep carbon emissions from further heating the planet and inundating our cities and coastlines with a rising sea. So it'd be logical to turn to green products of various kinds, like biofuels, organic food, and carbon offsets. Unless, of course, as Heather Rogers argues, such products do little to heal the environment and, in fact, often are ecologically damaging themselves. The author of Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution, which is published by Scribner, asserts that no solution will suffice unless it takes on the market system that structures our lives and economies. I spoke to Heather Rogers 2 months ago, and I asked her to explain the received wisdom about why buying green products makes sense.
What we're told is that if consumers demand green products, that will force manufacturers to make changes and in order to meet that demand, and that will transform our economy from a dirty one into a clean one. And what I found in researching my book is that we can demand green products all we want, and it lacks the power to truly transform. Say, for example, with food, the greater demand in organic food is leading to the transformation of organic by the industrial food system instead of organic transforming the industrial food system. So there are serious limitations if we just look at this problem and deal with this problem, first on a level of individual consumer choices, and second on the level of products, of commodity-based consumer-oriented solutions. If we don't go deeper and address the real workings of our political and economic system, the economic logic that must have growth, then we're not going, and that growth is fueled by ongoing, intensifying, expanding extraction of resources from nature, production, consumption, and wasting. That's what the growth is based on. And when we don't have that, the economy falls into crisis. And so if we continue to have an economy that has to function that way, there's no way that we are going to truly protect the environment, truly protect human health, just by you and me buying a hybrid car or putting biodiesel in our cars.
You start the book by talking about the food riots that took place around the world in 2007 and the reason, or at least one of the main reasons, why these riots took place. Can you remind our listeners what happened during that time and what you see as one of the key roots of that crisis?
At that time, between 2007 and 2008, the price of grains, just corn and also rice and wheat and oil crops, canola oil, palm oil, went through the roof. And it was in a very short time span. There were riots in over 30 countries around the world, sometimes violent riots. The prime minister in Haiti was ousted over a lack of access to food. That's why people were rioting. Working class people in Mexico could no longer afford to buy tortillas made from corn, which is a staple of the diet. Working people couldn't afford it. The price of corn had gone up by 80% in 1 year alone. And the way that it was talked about at the time was that this was triggered by the increased demand for ethanol, for biofuels. And ethanol is refined from a couple different crops, but corn is the primary crop that ethanol is refined from in the United States. So what a lot of people were saying, including in environmental circles, was, we can't feed our cars and not our people. And that's true. There was a huge boost in demand triggered by mandatory consumption of biofuels by the Bush administration, which incidentally have been carried on and expanded by the Obama administration, and also by mandatory consumption of biofuels in Europe and a number of other countries. So what it was attributed to at the time so often was this increased sending of crops to refineries instead of for food. But in reality, what was going on was that there was so much market speculation going on, so much commodity speculation going on, that in fact, there wasn't a shortage of food. What was really going on was a shortage of money to buy it. And this ties into this whole, you know, the larger questions about, you know, biofuels are having a tremendous social and environmental impact, but they're of a different sort, which I get into more in my book, that has to do with the land use changes, the massive deforestation that it's driving, and the dispossession of Native Indigenous communities. So this, you know, the questions are deeply connected to these issues, but just in a different way than a lot of people believe that they were.
And biofuels, or at least ethanol, is actually fairly controversial. Scientists are disputing whether or not, in fact, ethanol is a net benefit for the environment in terms of carbon emissions.
Absolutely. Really, in 2008, were the first studies that came out that said, wait a minute, you know, there had been some people doing calculations, like David Pimentel, who's at Cornell. You know, he's been doing calculations for a number of years saying, look, it takes more energy, or it takes a lot, you know, the amount of energy, the amount of fossil fuels it takes to make the corn ethanol is almost as much as the energy that you get from the corn ethanol. Therefore, it's not worth it. And there were a couple studies that came out in 2008 and another one in 2009 that said, actually, refining ethanol from corn can release more carbon emissions than if we just use fossil fuels. And the most recent study says corn ethanol can create 90% more CO2 emissions than fossil fuels. And, you know, again, it depends on how it's grown, how it's refined, how it's transported. But ethanol is very controversial, and it has been for a long time among environmental groups, especially, you know, community-oriented grassroots environmental groups. And there's just a whole host of issues related to ethanol production, which is the United States. That's the primary biofuel that we use. When you just look at what comes out the tailpipe, ethanol releases 20% fewer CO2 emissions. Biodiesel emits 75% fewer CO2 emissions. But when you factor in all of the impacts that it's having in terms of driving the expansion of cropland, then you start to see a fuller picture of the real CO2 emissions. And that's where we really need to be looking at this issue.
Well, of course, in the United States, you could look to the Midwest, where farmers with friends in high places grow vast quantities of corn, which, you know, much of it, of course, is for high fructose corn syrup and so on, but also has been converted to ethanol with great environmental consequences. But you looked further afield to Borneo, where biofuel was or is being produced in the form of palm oil. Tell us about what you found in Borneo.
I went to Borneo, to Indonesian Borneo, to find out there's deforestation going on, clear cutting and setting the forest on fire in order to expand the plantations that grow oil palm trees, the fruit of which is refined into palm oil. Palm oil is used a lot as a vegetable oil in processed foods, but increasingly it's being refined into biodiesel. And just quickly, there's two kinds of biofuels. There's ethanol, which is alcohol-based and replaces gasoline. It's made from sugarcane and corn, crops like that. And there's biodiesel, which replaces diesel. And biodiesel is made, it's oil-based, and it's made from crops like soy, canola, and palm oil. So the plantations are expanding to meet the booming demand, and the way that they're doing it is they're just clearing forests, they're burning the trees that they've cut down because that's the cheapest way to clear the land in order to plant the oil palm trees. And they're also kicking people, sometimes violently, out of their villages and off the land. And I spent time in an indigenous Dayak village where this palm oil plantation has illegally been seizing their land. And the village found out about it when some of the men were out hunting. They just happened upon this chainsaw crew. And, you know, there was no consultation with them. There was no communication whatsoever. And these villagers have gone through all of the appropriate channels over the last couple years. They filed paperwork. They filed formal complaints. They've gone from the local to the national level, and they never get a response. And so, you know, at this point, in many ways, they're very much resisting what's going on. But it's really, I mean, the balance of power is so weighted against them. These are people that don't have electricity. They don't have furniture. They don't have running water. And they're up against the plantation that's establishing itself in their forest is owned by a company that sells its oil palm to another company called Wilmar, which is partially owned by Archer Daniels Midland. And ADM is one of the top refiners of ethanol and biodiesel in the world. So there are these great connections, you know, that follow the global economic connections. And after I spent time when I was in this village, the village head took me out to the edge of the forest to see, you know, we're deep in the forest. He took me out there to see where the deforestation had happened. And when we were out there, we actually caught a chainsaw crew and had to make a very speedy exit. But, you know, this is active. It's going on every day. And the deforestation in Indonesia is so intense that it has made that country the world's third largest CO2 emitter, trailing only the U.S. and China. And this is not an industrialized country. This is just from clearing trees.
That's incredible, and particularly incredible given that this is a particularly biodiverse region, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. The forests, the rainforests on Borneo, in Indonesia, those are some of the last large rainforests that remain on the planet. And, you know, Borneo is the last viable habitat for the orangutan. Once Borneo is gone, orangutans are gone. And, you know, when you think about, oh, we're doing this for renewable fuel, like, you know, clearly it doesn't make sense.
That is the voice of Heather Rogers. She is a journalist and author. Her latest book, which we're discussing today, is Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. And I am Sasha Lilly. Heather, you also traveled to Paraguay as part of an attempt to get a sense of actually what the real cost, obviously not simply in monetary terms, of a lot of the products that we buy and believe are green and will help save the environment and offset global warming. And of course, one key one is organic food that people buy because they think it's going to both be central for the ecosystems where the food is grown without pesticides, without fertilizers, and also for our own bodies. And when we buy these products in the supermarket and we see the organic label, we assume that all is well. Why should we be a little more skeptical and concerned when we see that label?
Right. As organic food goes big, you have companies like General Mills, Kraft, Walmart getting in on the game, and they need consistent, uniform feedstocks, as they call them, inputs, year-round. So forget seasonality, forget local. The U.S. has only 7% of the world's organic cropland, so of course they're going to have to go outside of the country, and increasingly that's what's happening. They're going to places like China, Chile, Paraguay. And when I ended up in Paraguay at an organic sugar plantation, and this plantation and mill, it provides a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. It sells to General Mills. It sells to White Wave, which makes Silk soy milk. It sells on the shelves of Whole Foods under the brand name Wholesome Sweeteners. Some of your listeners might have that in their kitchen cabinets. And what I found is, again, as I mentioned earlier, instead of organic transforming the industrial food system, what I found was something that's quite contrary to what we believe when we see that organic seal, which is, among other things, this plantation, because there's so much demand, in order to meet that demand, they're expanding their cropland. And to do that, they are growing organic crops on land that has been deforested from the native Upper Paraná Atlantic forest. And this, you know, this is not something that's environmentally sustainable. And it's really not what people expect from organic. And I think that a lot of people have questions and wonder. And, you know, the seal is supposed to give us an idea of the provenance, you know, a sort of assurance that all is well. And again, as long as we don't have those kinds of deeper changes, there's always that motivation to take advantage of the environment and, just having, the kinds of simplistic changes don't get at that.
Well, when a product does have a USDA organic label on it and it comes from abroad, what sort of monitoring system is there in the first place to ensure that the food is in fact organic and grown under particular standards?
Whoever wants to sell organic in the United States has to meet the USDA organic standards. And the way they do that is the way that any grower in the U.S. would, which is that they hire a independent certification company to come and inspect their farm and look at their records and issue the certification on an annual basis. What is happening in South America, so crucially, and the same thing in Europe, if growers want to sell in Europe, they have to meet European standards. And European standards and U.S. standards are pretty similar. What that means is that the standards in the U.S. and Europe are de facto global standards. So what we have on our books is really dictating what's going on in terms of organic practices worldwide. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, but it's absolutely the case because the markets for organic are here and in Europe. You know, it's not in countries like Paraguay. So the certifiers go down there. The certifier for this plantation, when I was there, is a company called Quality Assurance International, which certifies two-thirds of all the organic food on U.S. grocery store shelves. So it's a huge company. And they were not paying attention to the deforestation. They weren't paying attention to plantation engages in large-scale monocropping, which depletes the soil and wipes out biodiversity. And the thing, you know, it gets tricky because sugar cane is a perennial, and so the rules around crop rotation for perennials are different than they are for annual, you know, for regular annual crops. And, you know, you're supposed to do intercrop, you're supposed to mix other crops within, grow it within the sugar cane. I didn't see that happening. I interviewed the head of the whole operation, the head of the agricultural operation, and he didn't know of any plants that they were doing intercropping. And so what is astounding even more than that is that the practices that I found in Paraguay are actually completely legal according to USDA standards. So, you know, the standards were forged between 1990 and 2002, and the organic program was officially started in 2002. And the lobbying, the involvement of companies like General Mills, like Monsanto, these big agribusiness interests have had such an influence on the drafting of those rules, the content of those rules, that there are huge loopholes. And a lot of people who have been following this have been screaming this for years. And, you know, another really significant one is that chemical residue testing on produce and in soil is not required by USDA standards. I was shocked
Incredible.
To find that out. Yeah, it's not required. It's entirely at the discretion of the certifier. Now, the certifiers are paid by the farms that they're certifying. So the harder time they give their customers, you know, these customers can quit and, you know, fire them and go on to another certifier who isn't as tough on them. There's no mechanism to keep that in check. So it's not that different than the ratings agencies on Wall Street. You don't like the rating they give you, you just go to another agency.
Unbelievable. Well, you also write in your book, Green Gone Wrong, that because these standards are so problematic that, as you say, were finalized in 2002, there are, in fact, quite a few people who are farming organically in this country who are opting out of the system altogether so that they can't actually advertise or sell their product as organic just because they can't handle, I guess, the bureaucracy coupled with the fact that the standards are so problematic.
Right. And the standards are problematic. You know, when I was in South America, in Paraguay, I interviewed small farmers who sell their sugar cane to the big plantation, and they're registered organic, but they can't pay for the certification. If they did, it would be their single largest fixed cost. So, you know, this is a situation for, like, campesino farmers and also for small local farmers in the United States. It's expensive. The record keeping is onerous. And just incidentally, the way that the farmers in South America are able to attain organic certification is through that plantation. That plantation pays for the small farmer certification. In turn, what that means is that they can only sell their as organic to that plantation. So they're bound to that single plantation and all the implications of that. But in the United States, I spent time on a couple small local organic farms, and they're not, none of them that I went to, just by chance, I didn't plan it this way, none of them are certified, and they don't believe in it. They think that it's a stripping down of a dynamic process into a list of ingredients that you can and can't put on your crops or in your animals, and that it leaves out the social component, which they believe is really important. So the surprising thing that I found, you know, you go to a farmer's market these days, and the prices are exorbitant. There's one of the farmers I spent time with. He sells at the Union Square Farmer's Market in Manhattan, and he is, you know, this very well-respected farmer, considered to be a very savvy businessman. He sells his produce at crazy prices, $14 for a dozen eggs. Some of his greens sell for over $40 a pound. And at those prices, you would think, oh, this guy, you know, earns a decent, if not very, you know, healthy living. But what I found is that while the way that he farms is environmentally sustainable, it's not economically sustainable. This guy earns $7 an hour. So there's this idea that we have that these farmers, this romanticized idea that these farmers are going to lead the transformation of the food system. And that's definitely not going to happen if they can't pay their mortgages. So that's an aspect of the local food movement that really isn't being talked about, and it's key.
Another perhaps panacea that we have heard a lot about in the last few years is the notion of a carbon offset, which is, you know, since we're aware that, or most of us are probably aware at this point, that when you travel, it's devastating to the planet, the emissions from plane travel. And however, you can offset it by, when you buy your plane ticket, also then paying for a stand of trees to be built somewhere that will offset, sequester, I guess, naturally the carbon, and therefore the environmental harm is mitigated. What's wrong with that solution?
That solution is not as simple as it sounds, like so many of these solutions, just not as neat and tidy as they sound. When you buy an airplane ticket and the airline offers carbon offsets, often the button will say, you know, you pay $10 or $15 more, and often the button will say, offset my carbon now. You know, you click it and it charges you that money, and there's a sense that it's happening now. It's immediate. If you plant trees, there's a couple different kinds of offset projects. There's tree planting, as you mentioned. There's also things like building carbon neutral power plants that burn renewable sources of organic fuel instead of plant-based fuel instead of coal. So you build one of those instead of a coal-fired power plant and you're cutting emissions, and your money helps to go toward building that carbon neutral power plant. But say you plant trees. Well, those trees don't absorb carbon immediately, but only over the lifespan of those trees. Those trees might take 20, 30 years, 100 years before they absorb the carbon from your flight. And, you know, we need carbon to come down now. Something that carbon offsetting does is it creates the illusion that we are bringing carbon down now. And it's confusing because we all know that we need to make fewer emissions. We know that our emissions need to come down, but the only way we can really do that is to just simply make fewer of them, make less, have less emissions. With the carbon neutral power plant, I went to visit one of those. I went to southern India. For this book, I went to a different country for each chapter to stitch together a global picture of what's happening in the name of today's environmentalism. And so I went to southern India, and India is home to a quarter of all the world's carbon offset projects. So it's a teeming carbon offset market there. And one of the projects I went to was a carbon neutral power plant in a rural impoverished farming region in the south. And this power plant burns sugar cane leaves, rice straw, the leftovers from harvesting rice, dead palm fronds. And the fact that it uses this organic material has put a price on that organic material, which used to be used, folded back into the soil and used as fertilizer. And it would be used by local villagers. Most of them are landless peasants. It would be used by them to make fires. They make fires multiple times a day. And it would be used, it would have those uses. Now what's happening is that all of that organic material is going to the power plant, and because people can't use the free stuff sitting around, farmers are having to buy fertilizer for their fields, and people who live in the region are having to, they're now having to buy firewood. So not only is it putting an economic burden on them, it's also driving the cutting of trees in order to, in order to supply the firewood to these people. And some of the peasants that I met told me that they're cutting down trees in order to sell to the power plant to earn extra money. And this is something that you just can't envision when you buy a carbon offset sitting in your apartment in Oakland or New York City or London. And yet this is the reality on the ground.
That's the voice of journalist Heather Rogers. She's the author of Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're airing a conversation I had with Heather Rogers 2 months ago. In the second part of the conversation, I asked her how it is that in the United States, 40% of carbon emissions actually come from houses and buildings.
Through heat and electricity use, those are, you know, it's hard for, we often talk about vehicles, and increasingly in the last 2 years we've been talking about weatherizing homes, and for years people have talked about solar panels, but it all kind of stays a little abstract. But when you look at the emissions that come from our homes, it's actually a huge number, and also from office buildings and other buildings. So what that reveals is that there's a lot of room that we can improve on this. And to look at how, you know, not only did I look at what's not working in the book, these kinds of false solutions, but I also look at real solutions. And I went to Germany, to the town of Freiburg, and I spent some time in, I rented an apartment in one of the two eco-neighborhoods, eco-communities in the town of Freiburg. These two communities have 15,000 people total living in them, and they're well-established. They've both been there for over a dozen years. And what I learned living there was that the kind of architecture that they use uses a fraction of the energy that we use in conventional buildings. They use a passive house which is an architectural building method using specific materials, super insulated, and they have things like, you know, exposed meters so you can see how much energy you're using, how much water you're using. But and when I went there, I expected to be kind of uncomfortable. You know, I was looking for, okay, look, we know that you can have a super eco home if you're really wealthy because it does cost more money. Or you can, you know, just go off the grid entirely and build an earth ship in the middle of New Mexico. But a lot of people don't want to do that. So what is there for the rest of us? And one thing about these communities is that they're mixed income. It's not just for wealthy people. It's not just for people who are content to live very unconventionally. And, you know, families, there's, you know, the people who live there are you know, there's, I met a truck driver, there's teachers, there's professional, you know, I met a bioengineer, you know, there's this whole range of people with children, young people, old retirees. So what I found was that, you know, this is very possible, and it can be affordable, and it's the technology is there. I mean, in many ways, that was really one of the big things I learned in writing this book in general, was that we have so much of the technology that we need. It already exists, but we are not using it in the United States and other countries because it's not profitable enough. And the other thing that I learned in Germany really deeply was that the community that I lived in was a product of a group of people getting together and saying, look, we want to make this environmentally sound, socially oriented community. And they built it on a former decommissioned military base. And they started in the early mid-90s, and they started meeting, and they came up with a plan, and they got funding from the German government, and, you know, they had actual weekly community meetings that anyone could come to, and it was something that was not the sort of fake community involvement of quote-unquote stakeholders that happens so rampantly here. They came together, they came up with ideas of what kind of building codes they were going to have, and also what they call the traffic concept, which is really pretty fascinating, because what it does is it prioritizes mass transit and bicycling over car use. And the way that they did it, and also pedestrian pathways and parks. There are parks everywhere. And the way they did it was that they you can't park your car on any of the neighborhood streets. There's a central boulevard where visitors can park. But if you live there, you can't park on any of the neighborhood streets. Instead, you have to park your car in one of two garages that are located at either end of the neighborhood. And that discourages, you know, it just makes it that much harder. If you want to drive your car to the store, you have to walk to go to get to your car. But you could just get on your bike and go to the store, or you could hop on the tram and go to the store. And they had to work very hard to get the city to accept that plan. The city wanted to make parking spaces in front of every home for everyone. And, you know, it was really a theory that they wanted to test and see if it worked, and it has worked. And they also pioneered a really impressive, efficient, easy car sharing system in the neighborhood too. And so, you know, and the other thing that I really learned was that it's a process. Doing all of this, getting to a place of greater environmental and social sustainability, is a process. It's not a product that we can buy. And it's an ongoing process. The people that I met there, the day after I left, a group of people was going back to the city council to continue, you know, arguing that they needed to keep the traffic, you know, their traffic concept in place, because there is constant pressure for them to give it up and other aspects of life in the neighborhood. So it's an ongoing engagement, and that's really, you know, what gets at how we can get to solutions that work.
Well, one place that, of course, is very large and has a great deal of resources, even after having declared bankruptcy, is the U.S. auto industry. And you went to Dearborn, Michigan, to look into why it is that the U.S. does not have the kind of efficient cars on the road that are available in other industrial countries. What did you find there?
Yeah, that was fascinating, spending time with auto executives. One of the main things I found there was that, I get into the question of what are the obstacles to us having? Why do we drive SUVs? Why does the auto industry, why have they historically focused on this? And what I found is that SUVs, and many of your listeners will know this, SUVs, the profit margins on SUVs are in the thousands of dollars. The profit margins on small fuel-efficient cars are in the hundreds of dollars, and sometimes they're money losers. So it's been in the interests of the auto corporations to make the most profitable vehicles and to cultivate desire and consumer demand for those vehicles. And there's also a role that the EPA plays in their estimation of fuel economy, which goes on the sticker of a car. In terms of why consumers, because all of the auto executives I talked to, they said, well, we just make what consumers buy. If people weren't buying SUVs and big trucks, we wouldn't be making them. And, clearly that isn't the case because they benefited so much from making and selling those vehicles. But I wanted to know, why are people buying them? And one of the things I found is that EPA does the testing, the fuel economy testing, and they have been inaccurate for so long, for decades, in their testing methods. It's put a much higher fuel efficiency figure on the sticker than you could ever achieve. And so people have come to mistrust that. But they can trust when they go onto the lot, they can trust that they're getting a more powerful engine, that they're getting bigger seats, that they're getting a DVD player, an automatic transmission, all of these things that they can see and feel and know that they're getting. Now, once you drive the car off the lot and you realize that you're getting 24 miles to the gallon instead of 30 miles to the gallon, you can't take that car back. So people haven't wanted to pay more for fuel efficiency, which is what the automakers always say. People don't want to pay more for it. Well, of course, people don't want to pay more for something that they're not sure that they're going to get. So that's another interesting piece of the story. And so what I found is also, again, as I mentioned earlier, the technology that we need to get to greater efficiency, it exists. It's there. And a perfect example of that is that Ford makes a car called the Fiesta, which they sell in the UK. And this car is a 5-seater. It's not a tiny little 2-seater or something. And it gets 74 miles to the gallon. Now, I mean, when I say that, when I do talks, I mean, some people gasp, And I mean, in the United States, a car that gets 35 miles to the gallon is considered highly efficient, but we can have something that's so much better. And the Ford is releasing a Fiesta version of the Fiesta in the United States in 2011, and it's going to get in the low to mid 30s. So the capitalism can create really impressive innovations, but it can also stand in the way of innovation. And that's something that you see so clearly in the auto industry. Another thing you see in the auto industry is that the market can't create the kinds of changes that we need. It can't adequately value environmental health. And so in Europe and the UK, Ford is making these cars that are so much more efficient because they have to, because there's a de facto carbon tax there. The price of fuel, transportation fuel, is so much higher in those countries. 60% of what you pay at the pump is tax on fuel. And so people will not buy cars that get 20 miles to the gallon. They just can't justify it. So in order to sell to people, Ford has had to change, had to make products that fit that you know, that system. So we know they can do it, but they don't have to do it here, so they're not doing it here. So that's just a demonstration of how good regulations can be effective.
Right. So the rest of the program, I want to ask you about kind of moving on beyond despair and thinking about what can be done. As you say, it appears that there are, in fact, all sorts of things that can be done, but they are dependent on either the lack of social organizing to demand regulation, and then more broadly about the nature of capitalism itself. Clearly, as you've alluded to, it's not in the interest of those who profit from growth to support conservation, which is a great deal of what appears to be the solution for climate change. So what do you think can be done in the sort of short term, and then more broadly, what would you like to see happen?
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that's tempting to believe is just on the subject of conservation is this idea that we just need to achieve greater efficiencies. If you don't make more fundamental changes to the economic logic, the economics that are based on growth, that rely on growth, that when we don't have growth, like we see with the current ongoing recession, is that when we're not consuming, the economy, you know, falls into crisis. It slows and it gets very dysfunctional. So, if we shoot for and achieve greater efficiencies, but we don't change that, the system, the economic framework, what we're going to get is that it's still going to be driven by the need for growth and expansion. And an illustration of that is, you know, Walmart has transformed its truck fleet to be more fuel efficient. It has transformed its stores to make them more energy efficient. But what does that mean? Walmart doesn't take those efficiencies, those energy efficiencies, and retire them. Walmart takes the savings from those efficiencies and channels it right back into growing the business, right back into setting up another Walmart and another Walmart and another Walmart to sell more stuff that's going to end up in the landfill. So, you know, it's really important for us to be kind of disabused of the idea that all we need is greater efficiency, because I mean, capitalism is constantly seeking out efficiencies. That's one of the things that it does really well. That doesn't mean that we're going to be protecting the environment. The thing that I think is really important to do is to start differentiating between growth and development, because when we say, I mean, look, the bottom line is that we need to consume less. That's really what we need to do. Well, when you say that, people immediately think that you're telling them that they have to sacrifice. And one of the things, I'm totally not into guilt. I don't think it serves any purpose. I don't think it's useful. It's been such a big part of how people have talked about environmental issues and environmental health. And what I'm really interested in is not the individual choices that we make as consumers. I'm interested in the choices that are made on the larger level, the political choices, the choices that industries make, the choice that oil companies make when they go out into the deep sea and drill for oil, and the choices that government makes when they let them do that, and when they let them essentially regulate themselves. So those are the kinds of choices. That's the kind of profligacy that we need to be focused on.
And that seems particularly important right now, in that, in fact, what's going on within the societies as a whole in the, you know, advanced industrial countries is, in fact, austerity for people, cutting back people's wages, laying people off, and so on. And so there's always that danger that a message that we need to tighten our belts environmentally feeds in, actually, to that larger agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't help but draw comparisons to what's happening in the Gulf, where really so many of the people that are paying are the fisher, you know, the people who rely on fishing, the people that work on the rigs. I mean, these are working class people, and they're the ones who are really suffering, in addition to the wildlife and, you know, the overall ecosystem. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, Obama's economic interests will stay relatively intact. By separating out this idea of growth from development, I think that we can start to pull apart some of that power dynamic, that great disparity in power. And it's important for us to be conscious of the fact that people in developing countries need to have access to better quality of life. They need to have access to electricity and education and healthcare and, all of these things that make life much more enjoyable, much more sustainable, much more healthy and humane. And, you know, when we talk about consuming less, that's another thing that often comes up, is that, well, now we're saying that people in developed countries can't have what we have. Well, they don't need the kinds of profligacy that our economic system, relies on and creates, the wasting, the kinds of wasting that just, really don't serve anyone's interests except for the interests of profits and of capital. And we need development. We need people to have a good standard of living. And many people understand that we can have a good standard of living.
Heather, I want to end by asking you about the phenomenon of green cooptation, which is really a theme underlying a lot of what you've said in this hour, which is that we can be made to believe that we're going to solve these really vast problems that have their roots in capitalism by buying green commodities, by buying products that are supposedly green. And you write about how there has been a sort of dance almost between environmental movements appearing and then co-optation by corporations or governments. And it's something that you actually wrote very eloquently about in your terrific book, Gone Tomorrow, about garbage and how concerns that emerged in the late 60s and early 70s then got sidetracked into corporate-controlled notions of how we should express or how we should see environmental problems. Right now, obviously, there is great awareness around the environment in a way that I think you frame it as sort of the third wave, the first being in the emergence of the U.S. environmental movement in the late 60s and then again in the 1990s, and now around global warming. What can we do beyond what we can do as individuals? What can we do as people concerned about society and social movements to try and keep this kind of cooptation, which has now become so widespread, from taking hold and getting us sidetracked from the agenda of real social change?
Well, one of the things is to not accept that narrative of individual choice being the root of how we got here and how we can get out of it. Really, just, we need to get beyond that. I believe that we need to regulate industries so that we can have truly greener options. They can truly flourish, like solar, wind, geothermal. We need to stop letting government subsidize, promote, and protect domestically and globally big oil, big coal, big ag. That's something that we just really need to target. We have to implement policies that support CO2 reductions. Policies that support overall environmental health. We need to use existing technologies, and we need to constantly improve them, but we have to use the existing technologies. You hear it over and over and over again. Congress people calling for greater investment in research and development, and it's unconscionable, because we have the technologies we need. We just need to be implementing them. With the auto industry, we're waiting not for better technology. We're waiting for for them to figure out how to make existing technology more profitable, and that is not acceptable. And it's the same with mass transit. We're waiting. You know, the U.S. government is going to spend billions of dollars on helping clean up the Gulf, and they've only invested, Obama's only invested $8 billion in high-speed rail in the United States. Compare that to what he's investing in ethanol. Between 2008 and 2030, U.S. consumers and taxpayers will have paid over $1 trillion for biofuels, which are so flawed and so ineffective. Compare that to the $8 billion that he spent on high-speed rail. And, you know, these are the priorities that absolutely need to change. So those are other kinds of changes that we need to ask for. We need policies that prioritize sharing knowledge among scientists and other groups working on technology in the United States and globally, so that people in developing countries can have access to the technologies that they need to have a good standard of living without wasting the place, without trashing the earth and the atmosphere. So these are some of the types of things that we need to be asking for and talking about and educating ourselves about. I think there's a lot of ways to practice environmentalism and teaching ourselves about this stuff, finding out what's going on in the places we live, how do we want to get involved, you know, and there's a whole range of ways that we can, but, you know, there isn't just one way to do this, and we have to ultimately, I think, grasp that we need a different economic and political model that, you know, it's a threat to industries like oil and biotech. You know, they see consuming less as a far greater risk than, you know, a gushing oil well like what we see with BP in the Gulf. You know, not drilling out there is more of a risk for them than drilling out there. And the reality is that it's far more risky to drill out there to try to extract oil from oil sands in Alberta and around the United States. You know, the price of that is too high. It's too risky. So we need a different economic and political model to within which all of that starts to make sense and fall into place. And, you know, that's a process. Again, it's a process. It's not products that we can buy.
And that was journalist and filmmaker Heather Rogers speaking to me in June. Her latest book is Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. That's published by Scribner. And on tomorrow's program, UC Berkeley professor Emerita Claire Cooper Marcus talks about how urban areas and neighborhoods could be designed to meet the needs of children. She's got a new essay in a volume about advancing the observations of Jane Jacobs. And that wraps it up for this edition of Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or look up Against the Grain Radio on Facebook. And many thanks to our engineer today, Erica Bridgman.